Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Ted Flicker, filmmaker and now sculptor. In a moment, we're going to be speaking with composer Robert Rich, and while we're talking to him, his music will be playing at a low volume in the background. I'm happy now to welcome Robert Rich. He's a composer and performer of experimental ambient and electronic music, and he will be performing at Santa Fe Complex this Friday, the 4th of June at 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So your music draws on a lot of different genres. You've got electronic and synthesized music, and then traditional instruments and rhythms of Indonesia and India and all sorts of places. Where did you start? Is there a foundation upon which you built the music that you're doing now?
Well, the foundation is that we're all inspired by the things we grow up loving. And I grew up in a household with jazz music. My father's a jazz guitarist. So as I listened to, you know, as a child, listening to classical music and jazz, mostly cool and melodic jazz like, you know, Stan Getz and Barney Kessel and things like that, I ended up with a vocabulary of music that was somewhat maybe outside of the norm. And then, you know, in the early 70s, hearing progressive rock and psychedelia, kind of becoming interested in the way music had a certain kind of energy that attracted me, an energy that just felt somewhat magical and unusual. So I began searching for music that had some kind of, just that little kind of energetic twang that would do something in my head, and started building synthesizers around the age of 13. So between, you know, becoming interested in the minimalist composers like Terry Riley and Steve Reich, and then German space music, and then discovering Indonesian gamelan, and in the San Francisco Bay Area where I grew up, there was a lot of Indian music as well. Ali Akbar Khan had a school of classical Indian music in the northern, you know, Marin County area. And so just steeped in this musical stew, there was no real sense of stylistic boundaries. I was just interested in music that had energy. And so that was the kind of music I wanted to make.
It's interesting that you say energy. I was at home listening to your latest disc, which is called Lang, or has a Y in front of it. Yeah. How do you pronounce that?
Ilang. It's one half of the word for the fragrance, Ilang Ilang.
Ilang Ilang. I've always seen that written, but never heard it. Anyway, we were listening to it, and I was with a friend who said that she would like to sleep with that music playing in the room. And it turns out that you actually did, or I don't know if you still do, all-night sleep concerts.
Absolutely. Yeah, I started doing those around 1982. I was a freshman in college at the time. And I was very interested in the way that music could create a kind of trance-like environment, a sort of magical space. And I wanted to try to frame an environment that would encourage people to listen in a different way. And because people tend to expect to be entertained, like to have a party or fun or dance, and that I wanted to find a more sacred way of listening to music, a way that the music would take people into themselves, you know, into a meditative or trance-like state. And so the idea of playing all night was really a way to trick people into being in the same place for hours on end without expectation. I wanted to change expectation into something potentially magical or something different. And it was inspired a lot by some of the avant-garde, like the Fluxus movement, was playing around with these long, long performances in the 60s. And hearing that, for example, in Indonesia, in Java in particular, the wayang puppet plays would go on for days. The Navajo blessing ways often can be, you know, several days long for each of the different Navajo medicine chants. There's a tradition of very, very long-form music. Most of it is a tradition where the music is serving a ritual or a sacred purpose. And since we don't have those continuous traditions in our culture, I was interested in trying to frame that into a sort of an art framing, which is something that we can sort of digest in our more materialistic culture. And So I would encourage people to bring sleeping bags and a pillow, and the music would start around 11 at night, and it would go straight until 8 in the morning. And people would sort of camp out. And it wasn't that the music was designed to help them fall asleep. It was designed to activate the place, to create a kind of vibration in the air that would make an energetic nighttime experience, so that they would perhaps have unusual dreams or a more intense experience in their sleep.
And did they?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it was 100% success, but certainly the mood is thick, the atmosphere is thick, and there's this sense of something potential. And they did get a little bit of a reputation. They became somewhat infamous, perhaps because they were just so unusual that it became a bit of a tagline. But I think part of the reason they became notorious was that there was something different that they were offering. It was really offering a way to experience music with a different set of expectations, the long form and the slow, really almost subterranean kind of mood that it would create. So I continued doing those until the late 80s. I actually stopped only because I came down with an extended case of mono, and it just made it very hard for me to pull all-nighters. And then a radio DJ at a college station in Irvine, California, down in Southern California, he was very, very interested in having one of these happen and encouraged me to do them on the radio. So for several years, I did radio sleep concerts, which was not as ideal because you can't control the environment in the same way as when people are actually sleeping in the same room together in a kind of a public situation. But they had their own kind of value, their own energy, and the convenience that people could experience them at home. So that inspired me as the DVD format became more accepted. I realized that I could actually use a DVD to create a very long-form audio recording. And so for several years, I worked on collecting all the material needed to make a continuous 7-hour piece of music, which I released in 2001 on a DVD called Somnium.
Wow.
And, so it's at the time, I think it was the longest continuous piece of music released on a format. There have been performances of music, of course, live. That had happened for years, but it was pushing the technology about as far as it could go at the time.
I assume you didn't play for 7 hours straight.
Oh, well, when I was doing sleep concerts, I'd play for 9 hours straight.
No, but I mean for the CD or the DVD release.
Oh, no, the DVD was done by computer. You know, basically it was a studio recording assembled rather meticulously on a timeline, then having to deal with the computer technology at the time, which wasn't really happy about making really long audio files.
But, right.
You know, we had to work around that.
Yeah, we know all about that here at the radio station.
Yeah.
We're talking to composer and performer Robert Rich. So, speaking of the sleep thing for just a moment longer, you studied psychology and you did research about lucid dreaming. Was your music related to this at all?
You know, the music actually came before the research, but it shared a common interest in altered states of consciousness and the way that we could use our potential of our mind as a tool to become more aware of ourselves and to be a little bit more awake, perhaps, in our waking days. So it's kind of ironic that we would study sleep to be more awake. But the idea with lucid dreaming is to make use of these shifts in consciousness that we have at night and to gain more value from them, to learn about ourselves from them. And often lucid dreams are very ecstatic, marvelous experiences, and that sense of wonder in the dream environment actually can become transplanted into the waking environment as well. So I became a research assistant with Stephen LaBerge, who was one of the main writers and researchers in lucid dreaming, and that was at Stanford University. We started a company together actually in the late 80s. I was developing some technologies to monitor eye movements and train people to be better lucid dreamers.
Can you explain actually to our listeners what lucid dreaming means?
Of course. I'm sorry. I kind of skipped over that. Lucid dreaming is when you become aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. So your dream character goes, oh, wait a minute, this is actually me and I'm asleep. And you can become not only conscious of the dream and stay asleep and stay in the dream, but you can actually act consciously and volitionally in the dream. So often people find these lucid dream experiences to be ones where they can do anything they want. They often fly, they do marvelous, miraculous things, or they have sensual pleasures. It's a place where you can actually explore possibilities, and you can also heal things. A lot of people become very good lucid dreamers after they have repeated nightmares, and they teach themselves to lucid dream in order to correct this cycle of tension that's creating the nightmare. People with post-traumatic stress, PTSD, often people with PTSD will have chronic recurring nightmares, and lucid dreaming can be a very good therapeutic tool to help them overcome the dissonances that are built inside of that experience.
Yeah, I've had that experience myself where I'm having a horrible nightmare where something awful is about to happen, and then I say to myself, oh no, I'm dreaming, so I'm just going to go do something else now, and I just make it go away.
it's
quite useful.
Oh, it is, and often in that state of lucidity, you can actually confront the characters that are creating the nightmare in your dream and resolve some of those issues directly at the symbolic level. So, you know, if some monster is chasing you through the forest, you can turn around and, you know, ask the monster to come towards you and embrace it and say, you know, you're just a part of me. I don't have to be afraid of you. That kind of resolution often becomes integrated into the self in ways that are very difficult to accomplish by talk therapy or by simple behavior or medical therapies.
Now, you've performed in caves, in cathedrals, museums, planetariums, also lots of regular concert spaces. How do you adjust your music for the space?
Well, the music really suits itself well to unusual spaces. In Louisville, Kentucky, I performed in a planetarium at the University of Louisville, and those are wonderful spaces because people are expecting something slightly miraculous. They're expecting their eyes to be tingled, and they lay back in the dark, and the environment frames them into a behavior that's more conducive to deep listening. In fact, of all the names that people use for the kind of music I do, deep listening, which is a phrase coined by a composer named Pauline Oliveros, is probably my favorite way of describing it, because it actually suggests to the listener the way they can approach the music and how it can be a more intense and beautiful experience. So, you know, I've performed in three old churches on this tour, once in Toronto, at a big Church of Canada cathedral built about 100 years ago, and also in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and I played at St. Mary's Cathedral in Philadelphia on this tour. And although the music itself isn't, you know, of any religious persuasion by any means, it is dealing with the kind of experience that religion also deals with, which I think is a universal experience. I think we're given this capacity to appreciate the deeper meaning underneath the physical appearances of life. And I think my music deals a lot with that kind of question, with the miraculous and with the mysterious.
We're talking to composer and performer Robert Rich. So when you play, for example, the concert that's coming up at Santa Fe Complex, do you play instruments or is it all computer synthesized? What do we actually see?
It is actually far more live than people expect. Electronic music has gotten a bit of a bad reputation because in the kind of techno and rave circles, a lot of musicians just come in with a laptop and they push play. Or even if they are playing their software, it certainly doesn't look like they're doing anything. They might as well be doing their email. I play a lot of instruments. I play flute, I play lap steel guitar, and those I play on stage. I have a water phone with me on this tour, which is a metal sculpture that makes funny sounds.
A water phone?
Water phone is an instrument made by a guy named Richard Waters, and people are familiar with the sound of it because it appears on, you know, movie soundtracks fairly often. It's kind of a strange, metallic kind of sound. But there's acoustic instruments and there's live electronics. I have a modular analog synthesizer, the kind of old school thing that people might have seen years ago on the cover of, Moog albums and Switched on Bach and things like that, you know, from the 70s. And this is the old school thing with wires and knobs and blinky lights. I've got a little one that I've integrated very closely to the computer, so it's actually making a lot of sound live, and I'm moving those sounds around like Putty, you know, with knobs and wires. So there's keyboards, and the whole thing becomes a kind of composite instrument. Probably my main solo instruments are flutes that I make myself out of PVC pipe, and it looks a little strange to people at the distance. I think, you know, are those sprinkler pipes? Yes, right. Indeed, that's what they are. And a lap steel guitar, which I tend to play with some unusual techniques, which create a vocal-like sound, or sometimes a continuous, you know, sustain using a thing called an EBO, which is like a magnetic sustaining device.
I knew a guy in Boston who made a didgeridoo out of a piece of PVC pipe, and it sounded great.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, it's not uncommon. Stuart Dempster, a jazz trombonist who also does a lot of experimental classical music, has a whole series of didgeridoos of ABS pipe, like a sewer pipe, that he's fitted together so they can be elongated like a trombone. But yeah, I don't play didgeridoo, but it is a similar kind of idea.
Do you actually, you alluded a moment ago to the expectations of people at raves. Do you actually play raves or environments like that?
Well, I try to avoid them. A few of the concerts that I have on tours, because in the venues, or I should say in the cities that I play, sometimes there's not a good venue for the kind of music I do. There is a lot of overlap with that kind of culture. But the main difference is that those people tend to expect a party. And they tend to talk a lot, and, you know, there's usually more of a, just a different vibe than the kind that I'm trying to impart with the music. I think my music goes a lot better with alternate listening environments where people are expecting to listen more deeply. Again, that phrase deep listening comes in. So the sort of rave environment really doesn't suit the music that well, although there is some overlap, the electronica aspect, the sort of energetic aspect of the music, you know, it seems to appeal to people who are looking for those kinds of experiences, but it's not very conducive to the party vibe, and that's one thing I've learned over and over again. It's really frustrating when people talk during my shows. It's much better when they listen.
Right.
So in that sense, it's almost closer to classical music, or like if people have heard classical Indian music, or, you know, concerts of, you know, touring musicians from other cultures, kind of a vibe a little bit more like that.
When you go to new cities, do you connect with the local electronic musicians there?
Well, that's often the community that's putting on my concerts. There's a very communal aspect to this music where many of the people who listen to electronic music are also making electronic music. I think it could fairly be said that synthesizers are the new folk instrument. There's a kind of democratization that happens with computers and synthesizers where people can explore their musical creativity without, you know, a lot of training or chops. And that's a downside to a certain extent, because you have a lot of somewhat unfinished music or music in development. On the other side, there's a real upside that there is a very communal quality, and a lot of people do come out to my concerts to look at the gear and to see how I'm using it, and to kind of, you know, do the train spotting routine, I suppose. But the people who organize the concerts are often fans as well as musicians, and they invite me on a very personal basis. I'm often staying at their houses, for that matter. This is really a network of private promoters. It's not really professional promoters that are putting these things together. There's simply not enough money in it for them.
Robert Rich is a composer and performer of experimental ambient and electronic music, and he'll be performing live at Santa Fe Complex this Friday, the 4th of June at 8 in the evening. His website is robertrich.com, and you can also go to sfcomplex.org to find out more information. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
And we're going to hear now a piece of a composition from Robert Rich's latest disc, Ilang Ilang. Delighted now to welcome back to the show Ted Flicker. He is a sculptor, and his exhibition will be at the Goldleaf Framemakers on Alameda near St. Francis here in Santa Fe, starting tonight, Friday, June 4th, and running for a month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, how are you?
It's wonderful to have you. Now, it's a funny thing, because we've had you on before as a filmmaker. You've had a distinguished and long career in improvisational theater and TV and movies and now sculpture. Describe, if you don't mind, that switch from this incredibly communal, collaborative, kind of crazy world of making theatrical art or film to this very solitary or relatively solitary thing of making sculpture.
I don't know. Maybe I made a wrong choice when I was 18. I thought I wanted to be an actor. I thought I wanted to be Laurence Olivier. And I had a long, very interesting career in theater and films. But toward the end of it, I realized God never meant me to be an artistic collaborator. And I quit Hollywood in 79, came here, Santa Fe, and started writing books, very satisfactory, by myself. Wonderful experience. And one day I came off a book tour, and I was about to start writing another book. And I thought, you know, I always wanted to know about sculpture. And I went downtown, and I met this sculptor, Paul Moore. And I said, would you teach me? He said, sure, come tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I went there, and he had some clay ready and a bunch of photographs of a decathlon champion whose portrait he was doing. And as he worked, he explained what he was doing to me. And after about an hour, he said, okay, let's go get the stuff. And we went to Artisans, and we got the clay and the sculpture table and a bunch of tools. And we went back to my house, and I had a woodworking shop. I always liked to work with my hands. And he handed me a plaster portrait he had done. He said, okay, copy this. I'll be back next Friday. I said, wait. I don't I have to pay you for these? What do you charge for lessons? He said, oh, I don't charge for lessons. You have to give something back. I said, wait, hold on. It's obvious from the way you live, you're not a well-to-do person, and I'm rich. For God's sakes, let me pay you for this. And he said, no, if I charged you, I'd have to charge my other students, and they can't afford it. So today we're best friends. It's 15 years later. We've been to Italy looking at sculpture together. He is still my master. And from that day to now, I haven't written a word.
Is that right?
Not a word. I mean, it's amazing, and I have no desire. I suppose if something happened and I couldn't sculpt, I would be happy writing books again. But God, I love being alone in my studio. No, not quite alone. I love being in my studio with young, beautiful, naked women.
At least you admit it.
Oh, God, what's not to admit? It's a joy.
Well, there's so many pieces that go into being any kind of artist, being a sculptor in particular. You have to be able to understand human anatomy, the human form. Is that a gift that you always knew you had?
No. I can't draw for beans. Ask me to draw a hand or a face. I have no idea how to do it. But somehow, the minute I started pushing clay around, I knew that's what was meant for me for this third act of my life.
It's funny that you said a moment ago you thought that God never wanted you to be a collaborative artist. I was reading in one of your writings that at the age of 13, you made a challenge to God. You said, God, if you exist, reveal yourself. Well, he didn't. And you said, well, I guess he doesn't exist. As you have gotten older, where are you with the God thing?
Not as witty as Hitchens, but in the same place.
Meaning?
Meaning there is no God. What there is a bunch of writings that are called sacred writings, the Torah, the New Testament, the Koran, and there's a ton of mythology out there. I mean, the Greeks had a whole bunch of gods, and the Romans had a whole bunch of gods, and the English worshipped trees. Now, finally, after 50, I started sculpting when I was 65. It took me about 12 or 14 years to figure out how to sculpt in a way that didn't offend me. And now that I think I know how to do it, I'm adding to it what I spent 50 years doing, telling stories. And so I've been re-examining Grecian myths, biblical myths, and I'm having a grand time. I seem to be offending some people and rendering other people gleeful. But it's great fun.
I mean, I guess I was asking about the God thing because you're exploring in so much depth these religious stories.
Parables. Most of the religious stories are a kind of mythological tale that are used as parables to explain a religious idea. For instance, I've done a piece of Jacob wrestling the angel. Well-known parable. The commentaries are unending on every one of these parables. Most of the commentaries on Jacob and the angel say that he's wrestling with a man. A magic man. Then some say he's an angel. Some say it's the angel Michael. And some say the angel Gabriel. And in one place, I found a mention that the angel could have been a woman. And since women are what I like most of all in life, I decided I would have a naked angel. And the reason, of course, is that she's trying to get away from him. He's holding her back for two reasons. A biblical reason is she can't leave till she renames him from Jacob, who was the trickster who tricked his brother out of his patrimony, to Israel, the people. The other reason I decided was she represents his feminine self, and he isn't too anxious to let that go. So that's the piece I did. I'm doing, right now I'm doing the Annunciation.
Yeah, that's very interesting. This moment where the Virgin Mary is told that she's going to be
inseminated by God. Right. Well, what would any nice 14-year-old virgin think if an angel whispers in her ear, "Guess what?" Well, I realized I looked at so many Renaissance paintings of that and some Pre-Raphaelite paintings of it. And the one thing I never saw on any of the virgins' faces was anything but placid. And I thought, no. What would that girl think? And fortunately, I have a model who is more muse than model. She's only in town occasionally. And when she is, she comes and works for me. Nikki Rosen. I think I'm going to put her name on this piece because she inspires so much of it. She has a kind of profound understanding of life. And I realized I could teach her some basic acting exercises in sense memory. And so she would take a pose that would indicate what the story is, but it would be just a pose. So I taught her to find the real feeling in her own life that would produce the emotion of the moment I wanted. And damned if she couldn't. And she could do it every time. She'd strike the pose and we'd be just a pose, and then I'd say, "Okay, go there." And she'd go there. And the pose would be illuminated. Now, I just hope I can get that in the clay.
And so in this sculpture of the Annunciation, you have...
I'm doing this classically. I have the Archangel Gabriel with his wings and halo whispering in her ear. And the whole thing is about what's in her face and in the posture of her body. And I started to do a life-size portrait of it to get the feeling in the face, and I was going to do the piece half life-size, and which is I do fairly often, and I realized, I gotta go for it, so I'm doing it life-size.
We're talking to artist, sculptor, filmmaker Ted Flicker. I suppose this is where the acting in film comes into the sculpture, is when you can teach somebody acting exercises to get the face you want.
Yeah, well, of course. It's I can't do that to every model I have. Some models are quite beautiful and quite athletic and have a great body sense, and they can take the pose I want. And then it becomes more my job to infuse it with life.
Right. It's a funny role for a woman to be a muse. I remember studying art history in college and thinking, there is nothing in life that I would like less than to be somebody's muse.
But why?
Because it was... How do I say this? To me, it was... I wanted to be on the other side of it. In other words, I wanted to be the one making, if I was going to be in that role at all, I'd
want to be the artist.
The one making the creative decisions.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was a kind of powerless and passive role. But I know for the people who like it, they mm-hmm. like it.
Of course. I think it's inspiriting for a woman to be a muse.
Is your wife your muse?
Has been from the moment I met her. And listen, I'd be dead without her. I mean, she has taken a very, very stressed life and turned it into a living art for us. She ain't bad, Barbara.
Now, not all of your sculptures are religious figures or parables or myths. Mm-hmm. You also do very creative and sometimes funny representations of people you know.
Yes, I do. I do. I started out doing portraits of the artists that Barbara and I collect. And I started out doing them as either gods or mythological characters. And now I have a part of our sculpture garden, which covers, I guess, about 5 acres now, called the Avenue of the Gods, which has a whole bunch of the artists that hang on our walls. Dan Domingo, Michael Burt, Carol Mothner, Jeff Lawrence, a whole bunch of them. Jeff is Perseus, Michael Burt is Cincinnatus, and Dan Domingo is Dan Domingo. What can you do with Dan? He's an elder, and that's what shows.
Right.
That's fun, and I'm continuing to do them. I've got a list of artists yet that I haven't done that I intend to do, and I do them in between these pieces.
And I suppose it's a tribute to them. Do they like it?
Some like it a lot. Others, I don't know. Maybe not. Everybody's polite.
You also did a sculpture of Barbara Van Cleve, the great horsewoman.
Yeah. Well, she's a great photographer. You know, she's a photographer of the West and a pal of mine. And as a matter of fact, we met riding out of the same barn, I don't know, 20 years ago. And she used to invite a bunch of us up to her ranch in Montana. They have two ranches up there, a very famous 2,000-acre dude ranch that's been there since the 20s, and the family home ranch, which is 20,000 acres, where they've been raising quarter horses for about 150 years. And so we'd go up with her every June, last week in June, and we'd gather the string of horses that have been out in the pasture all winter and take them down to the dude ranch. And when they figured out we were going to the place where the grain was, they went at a dead run, and our job was to hold them together as a pack and get them there in one piece. Wildest riding I've ever done. It's like super fox hunting.
Right.
And that was fun. Barbara's is a great, great horsewoman. I met her first because I saw a photograph in a gallery she had done, and I bought it, and I wanted to meet the photographer. She's a great photographer, good woman.
And you portrayed her horse as a unicorn.
Yeah, because she is a woman of a certain age and utterly innocent, sweet, innocent woman, not an evil thought in her body. Pretty good for a cowgirl.
We're talking to Ted Flicker. There's also a story that you tell of, I think it was one of the first sculptures, one of the early sculptures that you did, which was an Adam and Eve. And it was inspired not by Bible reading, but by these two young people,
oh,
about
God.
20 years old, who posed for you, and you saw in them also a kind of innocence that you equated to Adam and Eve.
These kids, he worked for me. They're both young art students. He was 20, she was 19. And he had worked for me one summer as an assistant in my studio, and a nice kid. And they came to pose for me, and they were lovers. And I said, okay, get your clothes off, get up on the model stand, let me have a look. They got up there, they turned to face me, waiting for instructions. And I said, oh my God, that's pure innocence. Look at those two kids, they're so beautiful, so incredibly innocent. I said to her, go ahead, kiss them. And they fell into, she kissed them, they fell into a pose in the kiss. And I made them hold it, and I grabbed some clay, and I did a sketch of it, and it's a piece I call The First Kiss. So innocent, so sweet. Yeah, it's fun.
You work in different media within sculpture.
Well, yes and no. I do all of my sculpting in clay. I model. I've done some wood carving. I like that. That's fun. And then I cast it either in bronze. And lately I've been using this modern high-tech material, a polymer, that lives outside as good as bronze. And I can color it in the mix when I put it together. And it's non-toxic. And the casting can take place and does take place at my own studio. And I mean, I've my assistant, Brandy Peña Villa, does all the casting herself. She cast a 9-foot piece for me by herself. So, and it costs about a tenth of bronze.
Is that right? So yeah. This polymer, you can make it look like anything you want.
Including bronze, if I wanted. Yeah.
Very interesting. Now, you've been working, because you started this whole artistic sculpture process later in life, and because you didn't need to survive doing it, you've really had the freedom to work entirely outside the art market system.
Yeah. Well, listen, after 50 years in showbiz, I needed to do some art that was totally disconnected from commerce. So when I started, I said, well, I'm not going to sell this stuff. I don't want a gallery. I don't want an agent. I just want to do my work. And occasionally, somebody I knew would see the work and say, oh, I want that. And if I liked them, I said, yeah, you can have it. And occasionally, I would want to do a piece for somebody, but then I would give it to them.
Right.
But and now, I'm turning 80, the weekend of my first ever show.
This is your first ever show?
Yeah. And I'm only having the show because my pal Marty Horwitz of the Gold Leaf Framers and the Gold Leaf Gallery said, I want to give you a show. And I said, oh, okay, why not? I'm old enough. And so we're doing this show at his gallery. I'm going to have 12 pieces there, from very large to very small. And a number of them are my current work of the parables. I have a huge piece of the parable of Judith and Holofernes. You may recall Holofernes was an Assyrian general who was marching with 120,000 troops to yet again destroy the Jews. And he invested this small city on his way to Jerusalem. And the city fathers, terrified, went to the most beautiful woman in the city, who fortunately was a widow, so she knew about sex. And they prevailed upon her to go down to the camp and to use her womanly wiles to get Holofernes drunk and have sex with him till he collapsed with fatigue and then cut his head off. And the Renaissance, of course, that was a favorite subject.
Indeed.
My favorite is the Caravaggio. And so I did it, and it's, I love it. Everybody, as a matter of fact, two of my friends who have seen it, you know, Malka Drucker, my pal Rabbi Malka Drucker. Yeah. Malka and Gay Block, her friend. And Gay is involved with the Jewish Museum in New York. Want to get it placed there. Well, needless to say, that would please me.
So that, if you were sort of following the career path, that would be the next step. But that's, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Hey, at 80, what do I care? I mean, I care. I would love people to see the work I love. But the most important thing is I get to the studio every morning and do it.
And that's your work, and you are healthy and vital and full of creativity as you've always been. And congratulations on your 80th birthday and on your upcoming show.
Thanks, sweetheart.
The show is at the Gold Leaf Framemakers of Santa Fe. It's on Alameda near St. Francis, and it opens today, the 4th of June at 5 o'clock, Ted Flicker's sculpture exhibit. For more information, you can go to tedflicker.com, and you can also call James Rutherford at 204-6034. Wonderful to have you, and we'll see you there. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.